And of course, once a month, our reporter, investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, joins us with some incredible stories that she goes out and researches. Now, she's not going to be with us in July, but she's got some family things she needs to take care of. But she's with us this month, and she'll be back with us in August. And we're going to start by talking about a city I used to visit quite a bit when I was a kid living in Detroit. I'd go right across the Ambassador Bridge into Windsor. Something's happening in Windsor. She'll tell us about it in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Linda Moulton Howe back with us. Linda, you have really done an incredible job getting these incredible stories. You always do, but these fascinate me. I used to go to Windsor all the time as a kid.
Well, and you missed, apparently, the Windsor rumbling hum because
I did.
It didn't start until 2011. And that's the mystery. When you were going there as a kid, nobody had ever heard about the Windsor hum. But on, let's say since 2011, I've done several reports about these strange sounds that have included the Windsor hum. And it was only 2 weeks ago on Sunday, June 12th, that's this year, 2016, a Facebook page for Windsor hum and rumble haters suddenly filled up with reports and complaints. One person said, I have never heard it like that in 6 years that I have been recording. A lot of people are recording this sound. Never have I ever heard it like that. And this was Mike Provost. He lives in the west side of Windsor, Ontario, about 7 miles northeast of a place called Zug Island in Michigan. It's the corporation home of U.S. Steel, and the source, say engineers, of the irritating low rumbling that has been keeping many residents awake in the city of 210,000 since at least 2011. Now, Earth Files first reported about the Windsor hum on September 30th, 2011, the day after there was a large public meeting that was held in South Windsor in the arena there. Canada's Ministry of Environment had received some 400 complaints about this persistent rumbling sound. And so officials with the Provincial Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources Canada joined a consultant they had hired by the city of River Rouge, in which Zug Island exists.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to tell the nearly 200 residents that, quote, the source of the Windsor hum is an airborne sound wave originating from the general vicinity of Zug Island in River Rouge, Michigan, across the Detroit River on the United States side of the border, close quote. Well, now, Zug Island is about 1 square mile of land along the Detroit River that in the early 1920s, Henry Ford dug a canal around it wide enough to allow large ships to pick up and take Ford cars to various ports and auto dealers. And over the 20th century, Zug Island became increasingly industrialized with iron and steel works for car manufacturing and other big factory needs. One side benefit evolved from the surrounding canal. The island became off limits to the public and its security level increased. By 2003, one American steel company there went broke, and another bought it. That's when United States Steel purchased National Steel Corp. Today, a few hundred people work on Zug Island, including hourly workers at U.S. Steel, who are members of the United Steelworkers Local 1299. And during the 2008 global financial meltdown, even U.S. Steel had to halt production, but turned on steel production again a year later in the fall of 2009. So it was only 2 years later after that, when government officials and engineers began trying to solve all of these resident complaints in Windsor on the Canada side of what people kept saying was this weird hum, and others said it was rumbling. And that was when they had this meeting and the local city councilor announced to the audience, quote, this issue has made its way to the governor of Michigan's office. But, strangely, nothing has stopped or reduced the irritating noise, coming from Zug Island, that's not a mystery, the location. What is a mystery is, why haven't all the complaints caused some adjustment, and why is there no resolution? Well, I took that question to Colin Novak, PhD. He's an associate professor of mechanical, automotive, and materials engineering at the University of Windsor. And he studies acoustics, vibrations, and psychoacoustics. 3 years ago, in 2013, Professor Novak joined the Windsor Hum investigation, and he used sound level meters, pentagular array cameras, microphones to try to precisely identify the sound source in order for Canadian authorities to ask the perpetrator of whoever it would be in this research to fix or seriously dampen the noise. Professor Novak has hard data showing that the irritating sound averages the extremely low frequency of 35 hertz, and he has traced that 35 hertz signal right to Zug Island and what he thinks are the furnaces of U.S. Steel. He has even heard the sound rattling his own windows several times. Here now, from the University of Windsor in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, is Professor Colin Novak.
The way I describe it, when I'm inside a building, and I've usually been inside the building when I've heard it, it sounds like a very large diesel engine, whether it be a truck or more like a train locomotive, parked outside your house, sitting there idling and causing the windows and the doors to rattle or to shake. It's somewhat disturbing because it makes everything shake and rattle. Then you say, well, why would that be happening? It's just not natural.
Right. And is the rattling of the windows in the houses because the amplification of the 35 hertz is so big?
Yeah, because of the amplitude of the 35 hertz sound is so large. It's an airborne excitation that's transferred into structure-borne excitation.
Is there a cycle to it?
Yeah, it tends to happen more in the nighttime, early mornings. I've heard the hum myself, maybe around 9, 10 o'clock in the evening. We measured it and heard it several times around 11 o'clock in the evening.
Okay, is there a cycle in the frequency and the duration at night?
No real change in the frequency. The duration does vary. I heard and measured it for as little as 10, 15 seconds. Sometimes it's gone on for minutes. I've heard people report that it's been continuous for hours on end.
And the 35 hertz seems to continue and be pretty consistent no matter what the duration or time.
Yeah, there are a lot of industrial sources that can produce noise at 35 hertz. What makes this one unique is the amplitude of the energy, simply by the fact that the sound is being heard more than 10 kilometers away from the identified area of the source. That tells you that the energy is enormous. And there's very, very few industrial-type processes that can produce that amount of energy at such a low frequency. So that really eliminates a lot of potential sources that can make noise at that low frequency.
Well, I'm looking at The Guardian of June 7th, 2016, and it is saying that you have been able to link the hum to the U.S. Steel plant and a coke battery owned by the local utility company on Zug Island that is on the U.S. side, correct?
We surmise that the source of the noise is actually the blast furnaces at the U.S. Steel facility.
How did you do that?
Well, we looked at all of the different sources of noise that are located on the island. That is really the only potential source of noise that can produce frequencies that low at that great of an amplitude. It requires an enormous amount of energy to be able to do that. And blast furnaces are something that can be a little finicky at times. And what we are assuming is that the producer is making a custom product in small limited batches, which is why the sound is being produced for only short periods of time. Then it seems to disappear sometimes a couple of years, and then it seems to come back again for several months at various intensities, and then it goes away again. We're right now experiencing probably the third phase of the Windsor Hum over the last almost 6 years.
Right. You were saying that it's possible that U.S. Steel is making some sort of special object that could be producing this higher amplitude. Could you explain that more?
Steel manufacturers can make steels with different properties. And this is an assumption based on some information that has been given to us from various people that are involved within the industry. They may be either developing or producing small batches of a particular steel with properties for a customer. If it were a special steel, it would explain why they're having to maybe tweak their operating system beyond its capabilities, because their blast furnace is extremely old. That facility has been there for approximately 100 years. So it can be the case, just extending what those capabilities are and producing a certain steel, maybe a certain hardness. Maybe they have to go to a more extreme temperature in the blast furnace then, or introduce more air than would normally be required, and that could result in some of these sounds being produced.
Any examples, such as military objects?
That certainly could be the case. I don't have any facts to suggest that they are making product for the military, but there's certainly also manufacturers of military equipment and vehicles in Michigan, so it's a possibility.
What is puzzling, Professor Novak, is that Windsor is a city of 210,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
It's right across the river from Zug Island in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
The United States and Canada have been allies for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a complaint by that city for at least 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am puzzled about why there could not be some resolution.
Yeah, I share those feelings with you. The phenomena is certainly experienced by a great many people in Windsor. Not everybody in Windsor hears it, only in certain areas, but I would stick my neck out to say that at some point in time, there'd certainly be probably tens of thousands of people who have experienced the hum. It seems to be that the people closest to the island in West Windsor and LaSalle seem to be most bothered by the hum. But why? The only thing I can assume, perhaps, is because if it is indeed U.S. Steel, it's a private corporation, it's a for-profit company, and they simply don't want to allow access, they don't want to cooperate with an investigation. And quite frankly, I don't know what authority or power any level of U.S. government would have over that company, especially considering that there does not seem to be any complaints or noted adverse effect by U.S. citizens.
Because it's largely an industrial area on the U.S. side?
Yeah, exactly. And also, the facility's right on the water, and noise will travel very easily and efficiently across water. So the city of Windsor has essentially an unobstructed acoustic view of the island. That wouldn't really be the case on the U.S. side, because between the island and any densely populated residential areas, they have very large industrial buffer zone. And within that buffer zone, there are many different sources of industrial noise. And I think the propagation of this type of noise is drowned out by all the other activity.
I wonder what would happen if the territories were reversed and the hum were coming from Windsor and the United States was complaining.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I don't know.
Do you know if the Prime Minister of Canada has contacted President Barack Obama's administration in the last 6 years?
I don't know all the details of that. I know representatives of the Canadian government have tried to work with various levels of government on the U.S. side. I've attended meetings at the Canadian consulate in Detroit. We have met with representatives of the town as well.
Do you remember if there is any specific United States senator or representative who was in those meetings who wanted to come to some sort of a resolution with the city of Windsor?
There were not any at any meetings that I took part in.
Why do you think that the Canadian government can't get a resolution on this?
I really don't know. If the source were located, potentially it could be very expensive to fix. And then maybe a private company doesn't want to invest the money to fix.
What about military priorities that are highly sensitive in the Department of Defense and depending upon the U.S. Steel in Zug Island to produce something for the United States DOD, and that any inquiry into what's happening at U.S. Steel could open up that sensitivity?
Yeah, I guess that could be a possibility as well, although I don't have any evidence for that, but it's certainly not outside the realm of a possibility. We really need to get closer to the source. What I would like to do is put some monitors. If we can't get onto the island, put monitors closer to the island on the U.S. side. And that would really only require the cooperation of River Rouge. And in the last meeting that I was at, there was a representative from River Rouge.
In the U.S. Steel replies to your government, what do they say is the reason that they won't communicate?
They don't give us any reason. I understand. They simply say they have no comment. The town, River Rouge, in which U.S. Steel is located, they've all been contacted. And the short of it is we've been told that they have no interest in pursuing the matter any further, since the hum does not seem to affect anyone on the U.S. side. Given that, though, you have to keep in mind that this area is highly industrialized and there aren't a lot of residential areas that can be affected. But because people on the U.S. side aren't being bothered from it, they have no interest or motivation in pursuing the matter any further.
Baffling for people, Linda.
Well, you know, George, isn't it peculiar that between the United States and Canada, as long as we have been friendly allies, that something like this going on for 5 years with a more than one focus on U.S. Steel in Zug Island, that there wouldn't be a resolution? And that's why I ask him those questions. My own suspicion would be that U.S. Steel is manufacturing something that takes higher temperatures, is producing that huge amplification, and it probably is for the Department of Defense, and it would explain why that U.S. Steel isn't responding to any of the inquiries from the Canadian side, because perhaps they've been compromised with some sort of non-disclosure agreement. This is speculation on my part,
yeah. But
it is the best one can come up with. When it's 5 years, those people really are complaining about something that seems legitimately disturbing, and I just want to go again to 2 weeks ago, Sunday, June 12th, that the sudden increase in the noise and going to Facebook didn't occur just at night. This was very interesting. There was a guy living in Windsor. He's a drummer. And he said that he was waked up by a long, now this is interesting, long drawn out low frequency hum for the first time in more than a year, and it was 4 a.m. on Monday. And he said, quote, "It's like 4 in the morning, and I'm seriously waked up." And another woman noticed that this hum was in the morning when she was getting her kids ready for school. And the difference in the quality of saying that something is a hum versus a rumble, I don't exactly understand what we're dealing with.
Well, and it's got to be driving people crazy, Linda. Absolutely crazy. Great report. But up next, wait till you hear the next story. Well, come on out to our August 27th event in Asheville, North Carolina. It is getting very close now. A couple months ago, it seemed like it was forever. But It's really close. Full information at our highlight reel. You just go to coasttocoastam.com, click the information. You can get your tickets right online and come and see us in the very quaint Diana Wortham Theater there in Asheville, North Carolina. Great event. We're going to have a band there again. We're going to do some singing and just have some fun with three special guests. So it's all at the highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Now, over the years, we've reported on stories of dead microbiologists, a bizarre story, well into the 20s, 30s. Now, we've been reporting on holistic doctors that are dying as well, and bankers who commit suicide. Now, what about missing scientists? Linda, what is this story?
In the Antarctic, of all places. Well, a year and a half ago, in January 2015, I received my first email from a retired 60-year-old U.S. Navy petty officer who is a first-class flight engineer who asked me to only call him Brian. He entered the U.S. Navy in 1977, and he retired 20 years later in 1997. He and his C-130 crew encountered high strangeness in Antarctica from 1995 to 1996 several times. They all saw rapidly moving silver disks over the transantarctic mountains. Brian and his crew also saw a huge football field-sized hole in the ice, only about 5 to 10 miles from the geographic South Pole that was supposed to be a no-fly zone. But during an emergency medevac crisis, to speed up their trip, they flew across the no-fly zone and saw apparently what they were not supposed to see, this huge hole in the ice, an entrance to an underground installation. That's the question. Later, at a camp near Marie Byrd Land, some dozen scientists, probably 15 and maybe two women and 13 men, disappeared for 2 weeks. When they reappeared, Brian's flight crew was assigned to pick them up, and all were silent and appeared scared. Brian and his C-130 crew received orders to not talk about the silver disks, not talk about the huge ice hole and the missing scared scientists. And repeatedly, the crew was sternly told that they did not see what they kept seeing, but Brian was never asked to sign an official non-disclosure agreement. So now that he is retired from the Navy while still working in civilian aerospace, Brian wanted to share what he has seen and experienced with me at Earth Files because he is convinced that an alien presence is living and working on this planet. We had never met until Thursday evening, June 2nd, 2016, at the Contact in the Desert Conference in Joshua Tree, California. We organized to meet with his nephew, Kelly, and a friend to talk more about Brian's Antarctica experiences. We all went to a local Mexican restaurant in Joshua Tree, and after dinner, we kept talking until after midnight outside in the restaurant parking lot under trees. That weekend, Brian returned to his home in Phoenix, Arizona, and on Monday, June 6th, was back at his aerospace job while I was still at Contact. That morning, Brian received a surprising and disturbing phone call that he now describes.
Let's listen in.
And the voice on the other end of the line said, "Is this Brian?" And I said, "Yes." "Who's this?" Because I didn't recognize the number. It says, "I want to tell you that what you've been talking about, you need to stop talking about." And I said, "What stuff was that?" And he says, "We know that you were with Linda Howe on last Thursday night, and we know that you went to dinner at a Mexican restaurant in Joshua Tree, and we were aware of what you were talking about with her and other people, and that your experience that you had when you were on the ice in the service. We don't want you talking about that. Specifically, we don't want you talking about the scientist that you picked up after being missing for a couple weeks." And I said, "How would you know about that? I've only talked to certain people." And voice in the phone said, "Well, we know pretty much everything." And then they said, "Just don't be putting that out there anymore. Certain people would prefer that you not talk about that." And then I said, "Well, I'll consider that." And then the phone went dead. There was a click. Whoever on the other end hung up. I was like, wow, this is out of the blue.
What did you do next?
Well, I was kind of curious, so I took the number off my cell phone and Googled it on the internet. It came back as the general phone number for the NSA.
The National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland.
Yes. I called Kelly, my nephew, and he Googled it too.
Why would you get a threat specifically using my name now in June of 2016?
The only thing that I come up with is that report that's been going on the internet of that British documentary team that was down there in Antarctica.
Right.
Something that was found under the ice. That team went missing and they have not found those people since. Possibly that documentary team was in the same area where those scientists went missing for those 2 weeks, and that somebody doesn't want putting two and two together and going, well, you know, there's people down there that went missing for 2 weeks back in the 90s, and now these people are missing and haven't been found yet. Maybe there's a correlation there.
The British documentary footage that Brian is referring to was first reported in a March 18th, 2002 press release from the Atlantis Mapping Project in Washington, D.C. that began, quote, the U.S. government said it will seek to block the airing of a video found by Navy rescuers in Antarctica that purportedly reveals that a massive archaeological dig is underway 2 miles beneath the ice, close quote. The video was allegedly the property of a Beverly Hills company called Atlantis TV that produced the Atlantis Mapping Project channel for the BBC in London until 2015, when it was closed down. The March 2002 release also said that the Atlantis TV crew had disappeared and that two U.S. Navy officers had found the missing production crew's videotape, quote, in an abandoned supply dump 100 miles west of Vostok Station, close quote. That would be near the South Pole. The press release said the video showed a pyramid and, quote, other spectacular ruins and things they could not go into, close quote. Allegedly, Navy SEALs came in one or more helicopters to take objects away. Officials of the U.S. Naval Support Task Force in Antarctica denied the story and said the Navy did not possess any video shot by the missing Atlantis TV crew. But at the same time, there was another U.S. legal action to block the release of a hardcover book entitled Raising Atlantis by Tom Grenius, a novel based on fact. The book is about a secret U.S. military expedition that discovers ancient ruins 2 miles beneath the ice in Antarctica. The government allowed the first ebook version in the spring of 2002 to be released containing sensitive information about U.S. underground installations. But the fall 2002 hardcover was blocked until the sensitive information was deleted. Could there be a link between that big ice hole that Brian and his C-130 Navy crew saw near the South Pole in 1995 and the missing National Science Foundation scientist in 1996 and the 2002 Atlantis Mapping Project news release about their missing documentary crew that allegedly videotaped a pyramid and other structures beneath the ice? If the U.S. government is trying to cover up the discovery of a pyramid and other structures 2 miles below the ice near the South Pole in Antarctica, the secret would be revolutionary because the last time the entire Antarctica continent was free of ice might be 14 million years ago. So any advanced architecture on land beneath the ice would likely be that old as well. Brian, would you have ever suspected that we were being spied upon and listened to in both the restaurant and where we talked on the grass near the parking lot?
I would never have thought that. But now, my 20 years in the military, there are things that I saw that I really can't talk about that tells me and has shown to me that our government is capable of anything. Okay, so finding this out that they knew that you and I and other people were where we were that night, it does not surprise me. With the work that you do and as accurate as the information you find and as hard as you work to verify the truth of what you report on, I can imagine that you are watched quite a bit, you know?
We're supposed to be American citizens protected by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We are not doing anything that is wrong.
No, I don't think we are either.
And you were never asked in your service for the United States Navy to sign a non-disclosure agreement about any of those efforts in Antarctica, correct?
Yeah. At the time when I was in the service and those incidents happened, we were verbally told we couldn't say anything, to forget about it, but I never signed the non-disclosure of anything that I did while I was serving in the Navy.
In Antarctica?
In Antarctica, yes.
Now let's play an excerpt from our original January 30th, 2015 interview.
Here's this huge hole in the ice.
Wow.
Almost like a cave entrance, but it was large enough that you could fly a C-130 into it. A hole that went down. We were told not to fly that area, but we continued our mission and picked up our medical emergency and turned around and had to come back to South Pole to refuel. And when we got close to that air sampling again, we were told deviate this way so many miles and then turn back on course. Made our way back to McMurdo, and the entire crew was told to report to the skipper's office. We all got sat in this room. And this guy came in that nobody had seen before and said, okay, you guys saw this thing? You didn't see it.
And he means the big, deep hole.
Yes, big hole in the ice that was supposedly the air sampling station. We were told to not talk about it ever, and that area was considered off limits for research.
In your email to me, you wrote, talk among the flight crews was that there is a UFO base at the South Pole, and some of the crew heard talk from some of the scientists working at the pole of EBAs, an acronym for extraterrestrial biological entities, working with the scientists at their air sampling camp, which is the large hole in the ice.
Yeah. We're told not to talk among ourselves officially. But the guys, after a flight, you know, you have a few beers, and it's like, yeah, I heard these scientists talking about that there's some guys there at Pole that were working with these strange-looking men. They weren't saying, you know, alien or extraterrestrial, whatever. And that the air sampling station was actually a joint base with the scientists and the ETs.
In your email to me, you said, quote, none of the scientists would talk to any of the crew on the plane, and they looked scared.
That was a mission. It was probably a 2.5-hour flight from McMurdo in the middle of nowhere. We put this crew out there McMurdo had lost communication with. You're supposed to check in every so often by radio and tell McMurdo that everything's okay. So after they hadn't been heard of, we got sent back out there. Nobody around. All the equipment was still there. But the entire camp was gone. We called McMurdo on their radio to make sure that the radio was working, and we could hear McMurdo fine. A week later, supposedly the scientists had gotten back to camp and wanted to be picked up. And we went back in there. After we got airborne, I went back looking around, and these people's faces, they looked scared is what they looked. And I asked my loadmaster, where have these guys been? And he said, I don't know, I can't get any words out of them. Blank stares, and he offered them food and stuff, and they're like, nobody would take anything. And so they get back to McMurdo and unload their gear. It was put in isolation. Kind of weird, why is that stuff being isolated? With everybody talking in the camp, all the civilians. Yeah, those guys went back to Christchurch, and they had a special flight for these guys. And nobody said anything.
Am I understanding correctly that each of the science groups that you guys flew in and out of the Antarctic base, they knew they were going to work with extraterrestrial biological entities down in that big hole?
What somebody had overheard was that there was an installation joint venture at Pole, not necessarily at the South Pole station, but in the vicinity of South Pole, they were conducting some kind of project.
Between extraterrestrials and the human scientists.
Correct. like, man, what did these guys see? Why were they gone for 2 weeks that nobody knew where they were? It makes you wonder, is like, okay, so what is our government and other governments doing that we don't know about that's going on down there with visitors from somewhere else? And what possibly is still going on down there?
Hence the secrecy there, Linda.
Well, and I would like to reach out to all of our listeners everywhere if anyone has more information about the collaboration of American or other scientists with an alien presence underground in Antarctica, to please get in touch with me. I always honor requests for confidentiality, but I think there's something here that is so important, and there may be people out there who would like to whistleblow to some of us who are trying to get to the bottom of this. So please, if you can, you can hard mail me, or you can email me some way, and then we could communicate in some separate way. My email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Always remember and think about a reporter who files news about the Earth, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And one of the reasons why I really think there's something serious in all this pattern of these puzzle pieces,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that I tried to do about 5 or 6 months ago, I worked very hard trying to find the 2002 April ebook release of Raising Atlantis by Thomas Grenius.
Yeah.
This is the original, and according to the little bits of news that go back to 2002 from the Atlantis Mapping Project, this ebook, the government decided that nobody was going to read through 400 and some, it's a big book, 400 and some pages electronically, and then go through electronically and compare to a hard book that would come out in the fall a few months later. So they let slide that ebook. But the government did, this is a fact, there were legal actions to get out of the 2002 fall release, the hardback, Atlanta Rising, and it was specifically focused around the National Programming Office's continuity of government plans for crisis like 9/11, a nuclear attack, EMP pulse, that there is a secret government operation that would take down underground. We're supposed to have 9 or a dozen gigantic underground installations where let's say a non-elected group, largely made up of people from NSA, CIA, DIA, military, they are the ones who would go down in some order that is in this continuity of government. And this is referred to in Raising Atlantis in terms of the archaeological discovery in the ice. I have been reading the ebook. And the reference is to a Section D that came up in another circumstance that the government got upset about. But nevertheless, we've been hearing about this since Cheney and Bush went underground during 9/11. And so continuity of government appears to be the sensitive area related to what is happening in Antarctica.
But why there? Linda, we're going to talk more about this with you during our Conversations with You segment in the last hour. But when we come back, something else is going on the moon. Linda went out to investigate that. That's next.